Chapter 20. Historical Facts About Merchant's Capital. The particular form in which commercial and money-dealing capitals accumulate money will be discussed in the next part. It is self-evident from what has gone before that nothing could be more absurd than to regard merchant's capital, whether in the shape of commercial or of money-dealing capital, as a particular variety of industrial capital, such as, say, mining, agriculture, cattle-raising, manufacturing, transport, etc., which are sidelines of industrial capital occasioned by the division of social labour and hence different spheres of investment. The simple observation that in the circulation phase of its reproduction process, every industrial capital performs as commodity capital and as money capital, the very functions which appear as the exclusive functions of the two forms of merchant's capital, should rule out such a crude notion. On the other hand, in commercial and money-dealing capital, the differences between industrial capital as productive capital and the same capital in the sphere of circulation are individualized through the fact that the definite forms and functions which capital assumes for the moment appear as independent forms and functions of a separate portion of the capital and are exclusively bound up with it. The transmuted form of industrial capital and the material differences between productive capitals applied in different branches of industry, which arise from the nature of these various branches, are worlds apart. Aside from the crudity with which the economist generally considers distinctions of form which really concern him only from their substantive side, this misconception by the vulgar economist is explained on two additional counts. First, his inability to explain the peculiar nature of mercantile profit, and secondly, his apologetic endeavours to deduce commodity capital and money capital, and later commercial capital and money-dealing capital, as forms arising necessarily from the process of production as such, whereas they are due to the specific form of the capitalist mode of production, which above all presupposes the circulation of commodities, and hence of money, as its basis. If commercial capital and money-dealing capital do not differ from grain production any more than this differs from cattle-raising and manufacturing, it is plain as day that production and capitalist production are altogether identical, and that, among other things, the distribution of the social products among the members of a society, be it for productive or individual consumption, must just as consistently be handled by merchants and bankers as the consumption of meat by cattle-raising and that of clothing by their manufacture. Footnote. The sage Mr. Roscher, Die Grundlagen der Nationalökonomie, 3rd Auflage, 1858, has figured out that, since certain people designate trade as mediation between producers and consumers, one might just as well designate the production itself as mediation of consumption. Between whom? And this implies, of course, that merchants' capital is as much a part of productive capital as agricultural and industrial capital. In other words, because I can say that man can mediate his consumption only by means of production, and he has to do this even without getting his education at Leipzig, or that labour is required for the appropriation of the products of nature, which might be called mediation, it follows, of course, that social mediation arising from a specific social form of production, because mediation has the same absolute character of necessity and the same rank. The word mediation settles everything. By the way, the merchants are not mediators between producers and consumers. consumers as distinct from producers, consumers, that is, who do not produce, are left aside for the moment, but mediators in the exchange of the products of these producers among themselves. They are but middlemen in an exchange which, in thousands of cases, proceeds without them. End of footnote. The great economists, such as Smith, Ricardo, etc., are perplexed over mercantile capital being a special variety, since they consider the basic form of capital, capital as industrial capital, and circulation capital, commodity capital and money capital, solely because it is a phase in the reproduction process of every capital. The rules concerning the formation of value, profit, etc., immediately deduced by them from their study of industrial capital, do not extend directly to merchants' capital. For this reason, they leave merchants' capital entirely aside, and mention it only as a kind of industrial capital. Wherever they make a special analysis of it, as Ricardo does in dealing with foreign trade, they seek to demonstrate that it creates no value, and consequently no surplus value. But whatever is true of foreign trade is also true of home trade. Hitherto, we have considered merchants' capital merely from the standpoint and within the limits of the capitalist mode of production. However, not commerce alone, but also merchants' capital, is older than the capitalist mode of production, is in fact historically the oldest free state of existence of capital. Since we have already seen that money dealing and the capital advanced for it require nothing more for their development than the existence of wholesale commerce, and further of commercial capital, it is only the latter which we must occupy ourselves with here. Since merchants' capital is penned in the sphere of circulation, and since its function consists exclusively of promoting the exchange of commodities, it requires no other conditions for its existence, aside from the undeveloped forms arising from direct barter, outside those necessary for the simple circulation of commodities and money. Or rather, the latter is the condition of its existence. No matter what the basis on which products are produced, which are thrown into circulation as commodities, whether the basis of the primitive community of slave production of small peasant and petty bourgeois, or the capitalist basis, the character of products as commodities is not altered, and as commodities they must pass through the process of exchange and its attendant changes of form. The extremes between which merchants' capital acts as mediator exist for it as given, just as they are given for money and for its movements. The only necessary thing is that these extremes should be on hand as commodities, regardless of whether production is wholly a production of commodities, or whether only the surplus of the independent producer's immediate needs, satisfied by their own production, is thrown on the market. Merchants' capital promotes only the movements of these extremes, of these commodities, which are preconditions of its own existence. The extent to which products enter trade and go through the merchant's hands depends on the mode of production, and reaches its maximum in the ultimate development of capitalist production, where the product is produced solely as a commodity and not as a direct means of subsistence. On the other hand, on the basis of every mode of production, trade facilitates the production of surplus products destined for exchange in order to increase the enjoyments, or the wealth, of the producers. Here meant are the owners of the products. Hence, commerce imparts to production a character directed more and more towards exchange value. The metamorphosis of commodities, their movement, consists, one, materially of the exchange of different commodities for one another, and two, formally, of the conversion of commodities into money by sale, and of money into commodities by purchase. And the function of merchant's capital resolves itself into these very acts of buying and selling commodities. It therefore merely promotes the exchange of commodities. Yet this exchange is not to be conceived at the outset as a bare exchange of commodities between direct producers. Under slavery, feudalism, and vassalage, so far as primitive communities are concerned, it is the slave owner, the feudal lord, the tribute-collecting state, who are the owners, hence sellers, of the products. The merchant buys and sells for many. Purchases and sales are concentrated in his hands, and consequently are no longer bound to the direct requirements of the buyer as merchant. But whatever the social organization of the spheres of production whose commodity exchange the merchant promotes, his wealth exists always in the form of money, and his money always serves as capital. Its form is always money to commodity to increased money. Money, the independent form of exchange value, is the point of departure, and increasing the exchange value an end in itself. Commodity exchange as such, and the operations effecting it, separated from production and performed by non-producers, are just a means of increasing wealth, not as mere wealth, but as wealth in its most universal social form, as exchange value. The compelling motive and determining purpose are the conversion of money into money plus delta money. The transactions money to commodity and commodity to increased money, which promote money to increased money, appear merely as stages of transition in this conversion of money into money plus delta money. This money to commodity to increased money, the characteristic movement of merchants' capital, distinguishes it from commodity to money to commodity trade in commodities directly between producers, which has for its ultimate end the exchange of use values. The less developed the production, the more wealth in money is concentrated in the hands of merchants, or appears in the specific form of merchants' wealth. Within the capitalist mode of production, that is, as soon as capital has established its sway over production and imparted to it a wholly changed and specific form, merchants' capital appears merely as a capital with a specific function. In all previous modes of production, and all the more wherever production ministers to the immediate wants of the producer, merchants' capital appears to perform the function par excellence of capital. There is, therefore, not the least difficulty in understanding why merchants' capital appears as the historical form of capital long before capital established its own domination over production. Its existence and development to a certain level are in themselves historical premises for the development of capitalist production. One, as premises for the concentration of money wealth, and two, because the capitalist mode of production presupposes production for trade, selling on a large scale, and not to the individual customer. Hence also a merchant, who does not buy to satisfy his personal wants, but concentrates the purchases of many buyers in his one purchase. On the other hand, all development of merchants' capital tends to give production more and more the character of production for exchange value, and to turn products more and more into commodities. Yet its development, as we shall presently see, is incapable, by itself, of promoting and explaining the transition from one mode of production to another. Within capitalist production, merchants' capital is reduced from its former independent existence to a special phase in the investment of capital, and the levelling of profits reduces its rate of profit to the general average. It functions only as an agent of productive capital. The special social conditions that take shape with the development of merchants' capital are here no longer paramount. On the contrary, wherever merchants' capital still predominates, we find backward conditions. This is true even within one and the same country, in which, for instance, the specifically merchant towns present far more striking analogies with past conditions than industrial towns. Footnote. Herr W. Kieselbach, in his Der Gang des Welthandels im Mittelalter, 1860, is indeed still enwrapped in the ideas of a world in which merchants' capital is the general form of capital. He has not the least idea of the modern meaning of capital, any more than Mommsen, when he speaks in his History of Rome of capital and the rule of capital. In modern English history, the commercial estate proper and the merchant towns are also politically reactionary and in league with the landed and moneyed interest against industrial capital. Compare, for instance, the political role of Liverpool with that of Manchester and Birmingham. The complete rule of industrial capital was not acknowledged by English merchants' capital and moneyed interest until after the abolition of the corn tax, etc. End of footnote. The independent and predominant development of capital as merchants' capital is tantamount to the non-subjection of production to capital, and hence to capital developing on the basis of an alien social mode of production, which is also independent of it. The independent development of merchants' capital, therefore, stands in inverse proportion to the general economic development of society. Independent mercantile wealth as a predominant form of capital represents the separation of the circulation process from its extremes, and these extremes are the exchanging producers themselves. They remain independent of the circulation process, just as the latter remains independent of them. The product becomes a commodity by way of commerce. It is commerce which here turns products into commodities, not the produced commodity which by its movements give rise to commerce. Thus capital appears here first as capital in the process of circulation. It is in the circulation process that money develops into capital. It is in circulation that products first develop as exchange values, as commodities, and as money. Capital can and must form in the process of circulation before it learns to control its extremes, the various spheres of production between which circulation mediates. Money and commodity circulation can mediate between spheres of production of widely different organization, whose internal structure is still chiefly adjusted to the output of use values. This individualization of the circulation process, in which spheres of production are interconnected by means of a third, has a twofold significance. On the one hand, that circulation has not as yet established a hold on production, but is related to it as a given premise. On the other hand, that the production process has not as yet absorbed circulation as a mere phase of production. Both, however, are the case in capitalist production. The production process rests wholly upon circulation, and circulation is a mere transitional phase of production, in which the product created as a commodity is realized, and its elements of production, likewise created as commodities, are replaced. That form of capital, merchants' capital, which developed directly out of circulation, appears here merely as one of the forms of capital occurring in its reproduction process. the law that the independent development of merchants' capital is inversely proportional to the degree of development of capitalist production is particularly evident in the history of the carrying trade, as among the Venetians, Genoese, Dutch, etc., where the principal gains were not thus made by exporting domestic products, but by promoting the exchange of products of commercially and otherwise economically undeveloped societies, and by exploiting both producing countries. Here, merchants' capital is in its pure form, separated from the extremes, the spheres of production between which it mediates. This is the main source of its development, but this monopoly of the carrying trade disintegrates, and with it this trade itself, proportionately to the economic development of the peoples whom it exploits at both ends of its course, and whose lack of development was the basis of its existence. In the case of the carrying trade, this appears not only as the decline of a special branch of commerce, but also that of the predominance of the purely trading nations, and of their commercial wealth in general, which rested upon the carrying trade. This is but a special form, in which is expressed the subordination of merchants to industrial capital with the advance of capitalist production. The behaviour of merchants' capital, wherever it rules over production, is strikingly illustrated not only by the colonial economy, the so-called colonial system in general, but quite specifically by the methods of the old Dutch East India Company. Footnote. Quote, "The inhabitants of trading cities, by importing the improved manufactures and expensive luxuries of richer countries, afforded some food to the vanity of the great proprietors, who eagerly purchased them with great quantities of the rude produce of their own lands. The commerce of a great part of Europe in those times accordingly consisted chiefly in the exchange of their own rude produce for the manufactured produce of more civilized nations. When this taste became so general as to occasion a considerable demand, the merchants, in order to save the expense of carriage, naturally endeavoured to establish some manufactures of the same kind in their own country." Unquote. Adam Smith, Wealth of Nations, Book 3, Chapter 3, London, 1776. End of footnote. Since the movement of merchants' capital is money to commodity to increased money, the merchant's profit is made, first, in acts which occur only within the circulation process, hence in the two acts of buying and selling, and, secondly, it is realized in the last act, the sale. It is therefore profit upon alienation. Prima facie, a pure and independent commercial profit seems impossible so long as products are sold at their value. To buy cheap in order to sell dear is the rule of trade. Hence not the exchange of equivalents. The conception of value is included in it insofar as the various commodities are all values, and therefore money. In respect to quality, they are all expressions of social labour. But they are not values of equal magnitude. The quantitative ratio in which products are exchanged is at first quite arbitrary. They assume the form of commodities inasmuch as they are exchangeables, that is, expressions of one and the same third. Continued exchange and more regular reproduction for exchange reduces this arbitrariness more and more, but at first not for the producer and consumer, but for their go-between, the merchant, who compares money prices and pockets the difference. It is through his own movements that he establishes equivalents. Merchants' capital is originally merely the intervening movement between extremes, which it does not control, and between premises, which it does not create. Just as money originates from the bare form of commodity circulation, commodity to money to commodity, not only as a measure of value and a medium of circulation, but also as the absolute form of commodity and hence of wealth or hoard, so that its conservation and accumulation as money becomes an end in itself, so too does money, the hoard, as something that preserves and increases itself through mere alienation, originate from the bare form of the circulation of merchants' capital, money to commodity to increased money. The trading nations of ancient times existed like the gods of Epicurus in the intermediate worlds of the universe, or rather like the Jews in the pores of Polish society. The trade of the first independent flourishing merchant towns and trading nations rested as a pure carrying trade upon the barbarism of the producing nations between whom they acted the middleman. In the pre-capitalist stages of society, commerce ruled industry. In modern society, the reverse is true. Of course, commerce will have more or less of a counter-effect on the communities between which it is carried on. It will subordinate production more and more to exchange value by making luxuries and subsistence more dependent on sale than on the immediate use of the products. Thereby it dissolves the old relationships. It multiplies money circulation. It encompasses no longer merely the surplus of production, but bites deeper and deeper into the latter, and makes entire branches of production dependent upon it. Nevertheless, this disintegrating effect depends very much on the nature of the producing community. So long as merchants' capital promotes the exchange of products between undeveloped societies, commercial profit not only appears as out-bargaining and cheating, but also largely originates from them. Aside from the fact that it exploits the difference between the prices of production of various countries, and in this respect it tends to level and fix the values of commodities, those modes of production bring it about that merchants' capital appropriates an overwhelming portion of the surplus product, partly as a mediator between communities which still substantially produce for use value, and for whose economic organization the sale of the portion of their product entering circulation, or for that matter, any sale of products at their value, is of secondary importance, and partly because under those earlier modes of production, the principal owners of the surplus product with whom the merchant dealt, namely the slave owner, the feudal lord, and the state, for instance the Oriental despot, represent the consuming wealth and luxury which the merchant seeks to trap, as Adam Smith correctly scented in the passage on feudal times quoted earlier. Merchant's capital, when it holds a position of dominance, stands everywhere for a system of robbery, so that its development among the trading nations of old and modern times is always directly connected with plundering, piracy, kidnapping slaves, and colonial conquest, as in Carthage, Rome, and later among the Venetians, Portuguese, Dutch, etc. Footnote. Quote, "Now there is among merchants much complaint about the nobles or robbers, because they must trade under great danger and run the risk of being kidnapped, beaten, blackmailed, and robbed. If they would suffer these things for the sake of justice, the merchants would be saintly people. But since such great wrong and unchristian thievery and robbery are committed all over the world by merchants, and even among themselves, is it any wonder that God should procure that such great wealth, gained by wrong, should again be lost or stolen, and they themselves be hit over the head or made prisoner? And the princes should punish such unjust bargains with due rigour, and take care that their subjects shall not be so outrageously abused by merchants. Because they fail to do so, God employs knights and robbers, and punishes the merchants through them for the wrongs they committed, and uses them as his devils, just as he plagues Egypt and all the world with devils, or destroys through enemies. He thus pits one against the other, without thereby insinuating that knights are any the less robbers than merchants, although the merchants daily rob the whole world, while a knight may rob one or two once or twice a year. Go by the word of Isaiah. Thy princes have become the companions of robbers, for they hang the thieves, who have stolen a gulden or half a gulden, but they associate with those who rob all the world, and steal with greater assurance than all others, so that the proverb remains true, big thieves hang little thieves. And as the Roman senator Cato said, mean thieves lie in prisons and stocks, but public thieves are clothed in gold and silks. But what will God say finally? He will do as he said to Ezekiel. He will amalgamate princes and merchants, one thief with another, like lead and iron, as when a city burns down, leaving neither princes nor merchants. Unquote. Martin Luther, Von Kaufhandlung und Wucher, 1524. End of footnote. The development of commerce and merchants' capital gives rise everywhere to the tendency towards production of exchange values, increases its volume, multiplies it, makes it cosmopolitan, and develops money into world money. Commerce, therefore, has a more or less dissolving influence everywhere on the producing organization which it finds at hand, and whose different forms are mainly carried on with a view to use value. To what extent it brings about a dissolution of the old mode of production depends on its solidity and internal structure. And whither this process of dissolution will lead, in other words, what new mode of production will replace the old, does not depend on commerce, but on the character of the old mode of production itself. In the ancient world, the effect of commerce and the development of merchants' capital always resulted in a slave economy, or, depending on the point of departure, in the transformation of a patriarchal slave system devoted to the production of immediate means of subsistence into one devoted to the production of surplus value. However, in the modern world, it results in the capitalist mode of production. It follows therefrom that these results spring in themselves from circumstances other than the development of merchants' capital. It is in the nature of things that as soon as town industry as such separates from agricultural industry, its products are from the outset commodities, and thus require the mediation of commerce for their sale. The leaning of commerce towards the development of towns, and on the other hand, the dependence of towns upon commerce, are so far natural. However, it depends on altogether different circumstances to what measure industrial development will go hand in hand with this development. Ancient Rome, in its later republican days, developed merchants' capital to a higher degree than ever before in the ancient world, without showing any progress in the development of crafts. While in Corinth and other Grecian towns in Europe and Asia Minor, the development of commerce was accompanied by highly developed crafts. On the other hand, quite contrary to the growth of towns and attendant conditions, the trading spirit and the development of merchants' capital occur frequently among unsettled nomadic peoples. There is no doubt, and it is precisely this fact which has led to wholly erroneous conceptions, that in the 16th and 17th centuries, the great revolutions, which took place in commerce with the geographical discoveries and speeded the development of merchants' capital, constitute one of the principal elements in furthering the transition from feudal to capitalist mode of production. The sudden expansion of the world market, the multiplication of circulating commodities, the competitive zeal of the European nations to possess themselves of the products of Asia and the treasures of America, and the colonial system, all contributed materially toward destroying the feudal fetters on production. However, in its first period, the manufacturing period, the modern mode of production developed only where the conditions for it had taken shape within the Middle Ages. Compare, for instance, Holland with Portugal. Footnote: how predominant fishery, manufacture, and agriculture, aside from other circumstances, were as the basis for Holland's development has already been explained by 18th-century writers such as Massey, in contradistinction to the former view, which underrated the volume and importance of commerce in Asia, in antiquity and in the Middle Ages, it has now come to be the custom to extremely overrate it. The best antidote against this conception is to study the imports and exports of England in the early 18th century, and to compare them with modern imports and exports. And yet they were incomparably greater than those of any former trading nation. See Anderson, An Historical and Chronological Deduction of the Origin of Commerce, Volume 2, London, 1764. End of footnote. And when, in the 16th, and partially still in the 17th century, the sudden expansion of commerce and emergence of a new world market overwhelmingly contributed to the fall of the old mode of production and the rise of capitalist production, this was accomplished, conversely, on the basis of the already existing capitalist mode of production. The world market itself forms the basis for this mode of production. On the other hand, the inherent necessity of this mode of production to produce on an ever-enlarged scale tends to extend the world market continually, so that it is not commerce in this case which revolutionizes industry, but industry which constantly revolutionizes commerce. Commercial supremacy itself is now linked with the prevalence, to a greater or lesser degree, of conditions for a large industry. Compare, for instance, England and Holland. The history of the decline of Holland as the ruling trading nation is the history of the subordination of merchants' capital to industrial capital. The obstacles presented by the internal solidity and organization of pre-capitalistic national modes of production to the corrosive influence of commerce are strikingly illustrated in the intercourse of the English with India and China. The broad basis of the mode of production here is formed by the unity of small-scale agriculture and home industry, to which in India we should add the form of village communities built upon the common ownership of land, which, incidentally, was the original form in China as well. In India, the English lost no time in exercising their direct political and economic power as rulers and landlords to disrupt these small economic communities. Footnote: if any nation's history, then the history of the English in India is a string of futile and really absurd, in practice infamous, economic experiments. In Bengal, they created a caricature of large-scale English landed estates. In southeastern India, a caricature of small parcelled property. In the northwest, they did all they could to transform the Indian economic community with common ownership of the soil into a caricature of itself. End of footnote. English commerce exerted a revolutionary influence on these communities and tore them apart, only in so far as the low prices of its goods served to destroy the spinning and weaving industries, which were an ancient integrating element of this unity of industrial and agricultural production. And even so, this work of dissolution proceeds very gradually. And still more slowly in China, where it is not reinforced by direct political power. The substantial economy and saving in time afforded by the association of agriculture with manufacture put up a stubborn resistance to the products of the big industries, whose prices include the faux frais, the incidentals, of the circulation process which pervades them. Unlike the English, Russian commerce, on the other hand, leaves the economic groundwork of Asiatic production untouched. Footnote. Since Russia has been making frantic exertions to develop its own capitalist production, which is exclusively dependent upon its domestic and the neighbouring Asiatic market, this is also beginning to change. End of footnote. The transition from the feudal mode of production is twofold. The producer becomes merchant and capitalist, in contrast to the natural agricultural economy and the guild-bound handicrafts of the medieval urban industries. This is the really revolutionizing path. Or else, the merchant establishes direct sway over production. However much this serves historically as a stepping stone, witness the English 17th-century clothier who brings the weavers, independent as they are under his control, by selling their wool to them and buying their cloth, it cannot by itself contribute to the overthrow of the old mode of production, but tends rather to preserve and retain it as its precondition. The manufacturer in the French silk industry and in the English hosiery and lace industries, for example, was thus mostly but nominally a manufacturer until the middle of the 19th century. In point of fact, he was merely a merchant, who let the weavers carry on in their old, unorganized way, and exerted only a merchant's control, for that was for whom they really worked. Footnote. The same is true of the ribbon and basting makers, and the silk weavers of the Rhine. Even a railway has been built near Krefeld, for the intercourse of these rural hand-weavers with the town manufacturer. But this was later put out of business, together with the hand-weavers, by the mechanical weaving industry. End of footnote. This system presents everywhere an obstacle to the real capitalist mode of production, and goes under with its development. Without revolutionizing the mode of production, it only worsens the condition of the direct producers, turns them into mere wage workers and proletarians, under conditions worse than those under the immediate control of capital, and appropriates their surplus labour on the basis of the old mode of production. The same conditions exist in somewhat modified form in part of the London handicraft furniture industry. It is practised notably in the Tower Hamlets, on a very large scale. The whole production is divided into very numerous separate branches of business, independent of one another. One establishment makes only chairs, another only tables, a third only bureaus, etc. But these establishments themselves are run more or less like handicrafts, by a single minor master and a few journeymen. Nevertheless, production is too large to work directly for private persons. The buyers are the owners of furniture stores. On Saturdays, the master visits them and sells his product, the transaction being closed with as much haggling as in a pawn shop over a loan. The masters depend on this weekly sale, if for no other reason than to be able to buy raw materials for the following week and to pay out wages. Under these circumstances, they are really only middlemen between the merchant and their own labourers. The merchant is the actual capitalist who pockets the lion's share of the surplus value. Footnote. This system has been developed since 1865 on a still larger scale. For details, see the first report of the Select Committee of the House of Lords on the sweating system. London, 1888. End of footnote. Almost the same applies in the transition to manufacture of branches formerly carried on as handicrafts or sidelines to rural industries. The transition to large-scale industry depends on the technical development of these small owner-operated establishments, wherever they employ machinery that admits of a handicraft-like operation. The machine is driven by steam instead of by hand. This is of late the case, for instance, in the English hosiery industry. There is, consequently, a threefold transition. First, the merchant becomes directly an industrial capitalist. This is true in crafts based on trade, especially crafts producing luxuries and imported by merchants together with the raw materials and labourers from foreign lands, as in Italy from Constantinople in the 15th century. Second, the merchant turns the small masters into his middlemen, or buys directly from the independent producer, leaving him nominally independent and his mode of production unchanged. Third, the industrialist becomes merchant and produces directly for the wholesale market. In the Middle Ages, the merchant was merely one who, as Popper rightly says, transferred the goods produced by guilds or peasants. Popper, Geschichte der Technologie seit der Wiederherstellung der Wissenschaften bis an das Ende des 18. Jahrhunderts. History of Technology from the Restoration of the Sciences until the End of the 18th Century, Volume 1, Göttingen, 1807. The merchant becomes industrialist, or rather makes craftsmen, particularly the small rural producers, work for him. Conversely, the producer becomes merchant. The master weaver, for instance, buys his wool or yarn himself and sells his cloth to the merchant, instead of receiving his wool from the merchant piecemeal and working for him together with his journeymen. The elements of production pass into the production process as commodities bought by himself, and instead of producing for some individual merchant or for specified customers, he produces for the world of trade. The producer is himself a merchant. Merchant's capital does no more than carry on the process of circulation. Originally, commerce was the precondition for the transformation of the crafts, the rural domestic industries, and feudal agriculture into capitalist enterprises. It develops the product into a commodity, partly by creating a market for it, and partly by introducing new commodity equivalents and supplying production with new raw and auxiliary materials, thereby opening new branches of production based from the first upon commerce, both as concerns production for the home and world market, and as concerns conditions of production originating in the world market. As soon as manufacture gains sufficient strength, and particularly large-scale industry, it creates in its turn a market for itself by capturing it through its commodities. At this point, commerce becomes the servant of industrial production, for which continued expansion of the market becomes a vital necessity. Ever more extended mass production floods the existing market and thereby works continually for a still greater expansion of this market, for breaking out of its limits. What restricts this mass production is not commerce, insofar as it expresses the existing demand, but the magnitude of employed capital and the level of development of the productivity of labour. The industrial capitalist always has the world market before him, compares, and must constantly compare, his own cost prices with the market prices at home and throughout the world. In the earlier period, such comparisons fell almost entirely to the merchants, and thus secured the predominance of merchants' capital over industrial capital. The first theoretical treatment of the modern mode of production, the mercantile system, proceeded necessarily from the superficial phenomena of the circulation process as individualized in the movements of merchants' capital, and therefore grasped only the appearance of matters. Partly because merchants' capital is the first free state of existence of capital in general, and partly because of the overwhelming influence which it exerted during the first revolutionizing period of feudal production, the genesis of modern production. The real science of modern economy only begins when the theoretical analysis passes from the process of circulation to the process of production. Interest-bearing capital is, indeed, likewise a very old form of capital. But we shall see later why mercantilism does not take it as its point of departure, but rather carries on a polemic against it.